I was on the floor trading in 08, 09, and I can tell you the fright of the market participants was over the top, right? So Bitcoin that lives on an exchange today might not be there tomorrow. If you have any type of financial crisis, right, 08, 09 type scenario where people begin to question the viability of their money in the bank, what are they going to do? They're going to pull their Bitcoin out of the exchange and they're just going to hold it on their Trezor until everything calms down. Well, everything I know about derivatives tells me that this ends in a mother of all short squeezes, right? The only solution to the problem will be, I mean, substantially higher prices. Had Bitcoin existed in 08, 09, you will have a supply shock the likes of which Wall Street's never seen before.
What's up, guys? Before we get started, I've realized that over 50,000 of you guys keep coming back for every single episode. And while I'm eternally grateful for you guys to keep coming back, I've realized that 79% of you guys are not subscribed. So I have one small ask before we get started. If you guys could hit that subscribe button and hit that like button to help send this interview and many more to the stratosphere, it would be greatly appreciated. All right, enough for me. Let's get into the show. Bing bong, I am back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast where I've got the man, the myth, the legend, Darkside 2030, excuse me, in the house. But Darkside, I heard a recent interview with you where you were talking about the potential of this Bitcoin supply shock. We just had MSTR having the most insane earnings potentially of all time today. So I want to hear your thoughts about all of these Bitcoin treasury companies coming on and the potential of this coveted supply shock that we are seeing.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me, Brandon. I look forward to the discussion. Let's dig right in.
Yeah. So tell me, what do you think of all of this? Do you think that there is the potential of a supply shock with what we are seeing here with all of these Bitcoin treasury companies now coming online and, you know, really just buying up days, weeks, months worth of supply in one big swoop?
Yeah, it certainly feels like we have the immovable object meeting the immeasurable force, right? We have a massive amount of buying coming from treasury companies, from institutions, from people playing the fiat Bitcoin arbitrage game. At the same time, we have an ever-growing and ever-expanding derivatives market creating synthetic Bitcoin, paper Bitcoin. Just in the last 2 weeks, we've seen 12 million shares of IBIT sold short. The amount of COMEX cash settled futures outstanding is about 121,000 Bitcoin. So then we get into the perp markets, the perpetual future markets globally, probably about another $40, $50 billion worth of Bitcoin there. So we have, at the same time we have this insatiable desire to buy Bitcoin, we have Wall Street creating synthetic paper Bitcoin, almost seemingly to meet the demand. Now, these two systems are antithetical to each other. Wall Street is used to large derivatives markets. Now, the issue with Bitcoin is that A, there's only 21 billion, it's an infinitely scarce asset. And at the same time, we have in Bitcoin, you have a market that cannot essentially fix itself, right? Meaning that if you look at traditional TradFi markets, they're always able to adapt to their derivatives complex. They're able to grow through the creation of more of an asset because the assets are almost entirely inflationary. Additionally, they're able to create a playing field by which hedging and the need for economic shorts is made available to the market. Bitcoin was never designed to have a derivatives complex, right? Satoshi didn't envision paper Bitcoin, synthetic Bitcoin, tremendous hedging of Bitcoin positions. It was created as a peer-to-peer money to live outside of the existing banking complex. So you can see where this is almost headed, right? At some point, and this is my thesis of the big long takeoff on Michael Burry's Big Short, is that at some point there won't be enough Bitcoin available to loan. And sitting underneath this entire thesis is a blockchain that's auditable and verifiable on average every 10 minutes. So what happens when we get to the point that Bitcoin treasury companies own 21.5 million Bitcoin? Well, it's checkmate. And arguably that checkmate will come a lot earlier in the equation. But for now, it's sort of like the golden age of Wall Street. They are just printing Bitcoin to meet the insatiable demand. But at some point, they will lose their ability to print. And I also would speculate that in the next financial crisis, and make no mistake, we will have a next financial crisis. But in that next financial crisis, we'll find ourselves in a position where institutions and even individuals, fearful of a banking system that's in potential freefall, will pull their Bitcoin off of exchanges and into self-custody, right? So Bitcoin has a couple characteristics that Wall Street's really never seen before. One, it's infinitely scarce. And second, probably even just as important, is that it's a bearer asset, that you can take delivery of it off of the financial rails. So how do you build an effective derivatives complex around an asset like this? Well, the answer is you don't, right? In the end, it's built to fail. And unfortunately, I would suggest to you that the compensation structures of Wall Street employees hasn't changed in decades. They didn't learn anything from 08-09, right? And the way Wall Street is constructed, the players are out to make money today. They don't look at the risk that they're taking 2 years down the line, right? If they did, they wouldn't be borrowing and creating synthetic Bitcoin, because in the end, there's not going to be enough Bitcoin to meet the demand. The underlying foundation of any derivatives market is that underlying asset, in this case, Bitcoin, is freely available to be borrowed and loaned. And when that tightens up, as we saw with GameStop, as we saw with Porsche and Volkswagen, as we saw with Nickel, right? In all of these cases, when the underlying asset becomes tight and you can't borrow it and you can't lend it, the derivatives markets freeze up, right? And then because Bitcoin is a bearer asset and you can just yank it up and put it in self-custody, you can see where this entire problem can become exponentially worse, literally overnight. And I think we're headed in that direction, Brandon.
Yeah, so let's dive into that a little bit more. So do you think this is essentially going to be the mother of all short squeezes, because we'll see, you know, the true scarcity of Bitcoin just really play through with all of this? Or do you think that they're going to try to muster up some solution, quote unquote, where they're issuing that more than that fixed supply of 21 million?
Well, you can't issue more than the 21 million, right? You can issue some. You can get to a number, but at some point, the amount of Bitcoin that's actually out there available for institutions to borrow and to loan will freeze up. Like the creation of IBIT, the creation of ETFs wasn't a mistake. It was intentional, right? The creation of cash settled futures on the COMEX wasn't a mistake. That's intentional, right? These are tools used by Wall Street to create instruments to easily short Bitcoin, to create derivatives complexes, to manage risk, to hedge volatility, right? All of the natural economic forces of Wall Street is that if institutions are going to get into a product, they want to manage the risk. They don't want high volatility products. They want low volatility products. And they use derivatives to accomplish these means. But in the end, it's not going to work this time. Bitcoin's different than any asset Wall Street's ever seen before. And its design, its very design, will be the undoing of the derivatives complex.
Yeah, so that is really interesting that you think that the design will be kind of the undoing of this entire, you know, financialized system. But in the interim, what needs to happen in order for us to get there? Is there going to be some sort of just major colossal crash where everybody's going to, not, I guess, a bank run, but almost flood all their capital into Bitcoin and then take it off exchanges, which would cause this giant tsunami up? Or You know, how do you see this playing out? Is it obviously, you know, you mentioned the derivatives market and how Bitcoin isn't really meant for all of this, but how do you see, you know, this kind of, I guess, you know, we're starting to see some cracks underneath the surface. How is it going to develop, you think, further?
Yeah, I think that the catalyst for the mother of all short squeezes, as I like to call it, will be a financial crisis, right? It may come out of Japan. It may come out of Europe, right? It remember, our financial system is so intertwined and institutions have so much counterparty exposure to each other that it doesn't need to be an American problem, right? It can easily be a global problem that spreads to America. But I can tell you this, that had Bitcoin existed in 08, 09, that crisis would have looked a lot different, right? I mean, it's funny because so many of the participants in the market today were not participants back, you know, it's coming on almost 20 years now, right? I was on the floor trading in 08, 09, and I can tell you the fear, I'll actually use the word fright, the fright of the market participants was over the top. I knew traders that were going to the bank and pulling out every single dollar they had in cash, putting it in their mother's freezer, right? It was that scary because we didn't know when Lehman failed. I think that was September 16th. Then September 17th, Congress declines the request for the TARP bailout funds, the $800 billion. Then the market crash has a virtual crash, I think on the 19th, right? In that time period, had Bitcoin existed, almost every institutional player would have bought Bitcoin and held it in self-custody. They would have gotten out of the banking system every last dollar they possibly could, right? And that's the part that people don't understand, is that everything's fine until it's not fine. Our system is fragile, right? I've seen the fragility. I've been doing this for quite some time. You know, I started on the options floor in 1989. I've been through long-term capital management, Russian default, internet bubble, GFC, like just go one after the next. And we've gotten to a point now where everybody knows the numbers are too big. If you ask any market participant with a straight face, you know, what does $37, $38 trillion look like? They just look at you with a blank stare, right? And the whole thing's almost ludicrous at some point. But here we are, and the system's kind of cranking along, but at the same time, we see the cracks. We see the cracks in Japan. We see our long-term interest rates going up when the Fed cuts the short-term rate. These are all signs of trouble. The dollar's declined, 10% in the last 6 months. I mean, these are all signs that the system is not healthy underneath the covers.
Yeah, the dollar actually had, I think, the worst start that it's ever seen in the year for the first 30 years, or the worst 6 months start to the year. It's been the worst in 30 years. So, I mean, I think that this is, you know, kind of lining out for the potential of just, you know, a big giant either recession or depression. But it seems like the only way out is to print. That's what everybody's talking about. Larry Lepard's got the big print. Lynn Alden says nothing stops this train. It seems like everybody in the Bitcoin space thinks that it's inevitable. Do you see it the same way? Because, I mean, we do have some kind of interesting, I guess we'll call it political theater going on with Trump essentially trying to strong arm Powell into cutting rates. What if I told you never had to sell your Bitcoin? Instead, you can borrow against it with Salt Lending. Why give up your hard-earned Bitcoin when you can unlock its value without letting it go? With Salt, you get secure Bitcoin collateralized loans with no credit checks, no prepayment fees, and best of all, no rehypothecation. Salt has had zero customer collateral losses since it launched. Salt was the first platform to offer Bitcoin collateralized loans starting way back in 2016. Today, they offer tailored options for both individuals and businesses. And now introducing Salt Shield, the no liquidation solution. No forced liquidations during the lifetime of your loan when you're enrolled with Salt Shield. This just launched at the Bitcoin conference in Las Vegas, and it is next level peace of mind. For Green Candle listeners only, head to saltlending.com/green-candle for this exclusive offer for your Bitcoin collateralized loan. You can get cash for your Bitcoin today. Salt Lending, secure, trusted, proven. I know that's a form of QE, but do you see that there's going to have to be some sort of, I guess, like mega print that's similar to what we saw in 2020 and 2008?
I do. Remember, there's two ways to get to a depression. One is through a deflationary spiral, a la 1929. The other is through crack up boom. That's Mises theory, the Austrian economist, where you essentially go into hyperinflation. They both end up in the exact same spot, which is an utter and complete depression. So I'm in the camp that we see a crack up boom. I think prices just continue to go higher. The money printer will go into full burr when Powell's replaced at some point. And I just think we'll lose control of the dollar to printing, not to a deflationary spiral.
Now, do you think that would lead to essentially just like an economic crash and burn globally? And, I guess it'll be a slow rebuild back onto a potential Bitcoin standard? Or do you think that, we're still going to have some, I guess, almost delusion in the market where, we're see some hyperinflationary signs, but people won't lose faith in the dollar as quickly as maybe the Bitcoiners think?
Well, it's a good question. I like to say the dollar is the world's tallest midget, right? So we're going to lose every other currency in the world before we lose the dollar. Now, to that point, though, if the dollar does begin to hyperinflate, it will crash, the global economy. But I would say this, that out of the ashes of that crash will be born a much better system. The system we have today is functionally it functionally does not serve society, right? We have a system that's created a complete K-shaped economy with the top 10, 15% of the country killing it and the bottom 85% really getting smoked, right? It's only the people that own assets that are doing well. So we're seeing right now signs of trouble, right? I point to the housing market because there's so much leverage built into a real estate. So between commercial real estate and housing, we've seen, obviously the commercial real estate story is well known. The housing market is starting to see inventories build past 2019 levels. We all know what COVID did. That was crazy. But as these inventory levels build, you end up in a real problem. So either they solve the problem with substantially lower rates, and how you get to those lower rates is not just a function of the Fed. Trump can yell at Powell all he wants about the front end of the curve, but that doesn't do anything for the back end of the curve, right? So you could cut the front end of the curve down to 1% tomorrow. I think the long end would go higher, right? And that would force the Fed and the Treasury into some form of Operation Twist, betterly known as yield curve control, where they're forced to buy down the long end of the curve. That's a massive QE printing exercise. That's sort of the last straw. It basically gets you to one of the last tools in the tool shed. And how long they can maintain that, I don't know, probably a couple of years before the whole thing blew up. But that's certainly seems where we're headed, Brandon.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you're, kind of describing the real estate market as well, because, I mean, we've just had this recent law that was passed by Bill Plute, where you can use Bitcoin as collateral for Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, for some of these, housing markets. Obviously, Bitcoin has been, the move for Bitcoin as a collateral has really taken off in the past, 6 months. So how do you see that as playing a role? I know you kind of talked about, the potential of these companies, using the traditional system to buy more Bitcoin, but what about Bitcoin as collateral?
Well, Bitcoin to me is the most pristine collateral in the world, but let's look at what's happening with MicroStrategy, since you mentioned it earlier, their creation of these perpetual preferreds, particularly STRF and now Stretch STRC, where they're creating a fiat yield curve on Bitcoin. So what does the market see as the appropriate rate for Bitcoin as collateral in the current system, right? And this is a monumental sea change in the way the financial markets, Bitcoin, will view Bitcoin, the way the government's going to view Bitcoin, essentially Saylor is making an end run around the rating agencies and telling the market, you go ahead and rate my debt. You go ahead and rate the Bitcoin that I hold as pristine collateral. So I personally believe these products are going to explode, right? I think you're going to see demand off. I mean, like he said yesterday in his earnings call, he mentioned that, well, to him, this STRC was their, I think he called it their AirPod moment or their iPhone moment, something like that. But he really now understands that the $6 trillion sitting in money markets earning 4% could easily migrate over to a Bitcoin-backed debt instrument yielding 8, 9, 10%. That's just where we're headed. It's just getting started. We're in pitchers and catchers, to use a baseball analogy. We haven't even gotten to spring training yet. So we're just getting started, but the world's going to change drastically over the next few years. Now, the question, Brandon, that we all need to ask ourselves is if they want to save the dollar, if they want to save the system as it's constructed, they need to start intertwining hard money, Bitcoin, into the system, right? And, you know, easier said than done. And the objection, you know, it sounds good at first thought, right? Like, well, let's just create bit bonds that'll yield 9%, and that will solve some of the Social Security problems, the Medicare, Medicaid, underfunded liability problems as yields would rise. But what would that do to housing? What would that do to car loans? What would that do to credit cards, right? So there's knock-on effects. We've gotten so far down this hole, right, that any attempt to fix the problem comes with second-order effects. So look, I hope they take their medicine and do the right thing, but my confidence in government is extremely low. So I will generally assume that the government will go down the worst possible road and get the worst possible result.
Yeah, and it seems like, you know, that's kind of a similar thought to majority of Bitcoiners and myself as well. And it's interesting. Like, how big of a role do you think MSTR is going to play in all this? Because I think one of the more interesting graphics that I saw was when Preston tweeted out this morning last night actually, benchmarking strategy versus the S&P 500 companies. And one of those unique things was if you look at the PE multiple of strategy, it's at 4.7. Of course, that's with massive amounts of earnings from their unrealized gains in Bitcoin. But, you know, with that, it seems like it's getting back to a little bit more of the quote unquote value investing principles, where it seems like we've kind of gotten away from that. And it seems like the market has just been, you know, kind of almost built on a house of cards where everything is all just, you know, very forward looking. The tech companies rising up to $1 billion valuations, then crashing and then going bankrupt. I mean, it seems like, you know, it would almost help the financialization of the markets to move towards a Bitcoin standard. But there is a lot of resistance, it seems, at least initially, from companies to get Bitcoin on their treasury. Now, with this massive earnings call that, you know, Strategy just had, do you see this as like an overarching shift where, you know, eventually every single company in the S&P 500 is going to have some sort of Bitcoin play?
Not yet. So let's kind of break this down a little bit. Strategy is a balance sheet based company, right? Their earnings are coming from their balance sheet, as you just stated. The entire concept of the Bitcoin treasury is a balance sheet play. Wall Street has spent the last 5-6 decades rewarding the income statement, right? And they use the balance sheet as a way of hiding problems. So you'll very often see a company report record earnings and then some type of one-time charge where they write off some bad investment and they just throw that on the balance sheet. And analysts ignore it because it's a one-time charge, right? That's sort of a trick. It's sleight of hand, but it goes to show how Wall Street has so degraded the value of the balance sheet and so inflated the value of the income statement. Now, what Saylor's bringing to the table
This bull run, I think everybody should focus on getting their Bitcoin in self-custody and off exchanges. We all saw what happened last time with the huge blow-offs. We had Celsius, FTX, all of the big dogs blowing up. Well, this time, everybody's being smart and holding their Bitcoin in self-custody. This is why I'm going with the number one hardware wallet in the game. That's Trezor. You can go to trezor.io or the affiliate link below to get yours for 5% off using promo code GreenCandle. Get your Bitcoin off exchanges in the easiest way possible. They are a trusted brand. They've been in the game the longest of any hardware wallets out there. So that's why I've partnered with them, making it the easiest for you to get your Bitcoin off exchanges and not have to worry about any counterparty risk. So do it today. Go to the affiliate link below. Use promo code GreenCandle. Enough from me. Let's get back to the show.
Is an entire, and not just Sailor, but all of the treasury companies are going to bring a balance sheet based company to Wall Street, right? And they don't like balance sheet based companies. Matter of fact, they never want you to look at the balance sheet because the balance sheet will show you any of the defects in the company, whereas the income statement and the earnings per share and all of the different metrics that they pull out of the income statement, that's how they sell their product. So it's really an interesting dichotomy to look at a balance sheet based company like Strategy versus an income statement company like everything else, and understand that real value is created in the balance sheet, right? If you're making all this money, the balance sheet should be improving. But when you see companies where they're making a ton of money, but the balance sheet is deteriorating, well, that should be a warning sign. Sailor's gone about it the exact opposite way. He's building unique products, but the real flow of value comes into the balance sheet. Right. And as the balance sheet grows, it's going to change at some point, not immediately, not next year, but at some point, some Wall Street analysts are going to get together and say, hey, we got to spend more time focusing on balance sheets. Right. And that will be when the sea change occurs.
Now, he did say something interesting in that earnings call as well, where he was kind of describing the balance sheet, you know, the amount of like cash or Bitcoin equivalents on the balance sheet, where, you know, I think it was the speaker after Sailor, I can't remember his name, I'm blanking, but he essentially said that it wouldn't surprise him to see Strategy move to the second largest balance sheet, behind Berkshire Hathaway by the end of this year or in the next 2 to 3 years, and then in the next 3 to 5 years passing Berkshire Hathaway and being having the largest balance sheet of any corporation. Now, those are some bold claims, obviously, to come in hot like that. But, you know, analysts are now starting to look at Bitcoin because they're having to look at MSTR, and, you know, for better or for worse, they're projecting Bitcoin's price. They said, you know, a modest 165,000, I believe, by the end of this year. With all of this attention now around the Bitcoin space, it seems like everything is just going to accelerate now. But there seems to be there's got to be some risk around that, right? So, is there any risks to these Wall Street companies and Wall Street and coming into Bitcoin at this point? Where maybe they just are, you know, it's a little bit nuanced and they don't understand the true scarcity as we were kind of lining out earlier, that there could be some potential downfalls coming with Wall Street coming in.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that leverage in the system becomes a risk. At this time, I think the total leverage of all of the existing treasury companies, obviously Strategy being so far and away the biggest, is about 16%. It's very low, right? If you get on Bitcoin Twitter, you would think we're in the greatest bubble since 1929, right? But the reality is we're nowhere close. I saw one stat that said back in 1929, the average leverage in the companies was somewhere around, you know, 1,000%, and we're at 16. But look, there's a narrative being spun now, right, by Wall Street. They're threatened by Bitcoin. Don't kid yourself, right? Bitcoin threatens the existing system unlike any invention in my lifetime, right? There's nothing even been close. Bitcoin is a deflationary system sitting alongside an inflationary system. These two systems cannot peacefully coexist, right? A deflationary system will eat an inflationary system 100% of the time. So is there risk? There's always risk, right? But over the long term, I feel pretty confident in telling you that Bitcoin will eat fiat. And that's what we're seeing, right? Like when you see STRC, when you see MicroStrategy, 21 Capital, the rest of them all coming out and buying Bitcoin, realize that that's capital leaving fiat and wanting to get into Bitcoin, right? And we're still in the we're in very low numbers. We have a $2 trillion of cash out there, cash equivalents. And we're talking about, you know, sub $1 trillion in Bitcoin related companies. So the door is wide open for fiat to find its way into Bitcoin. And ultimately, I think it will.
Yeah. And we talked a little bit and touched on it briefly of the big long, your theory for this, a kind of the anti big short, so to speak. So I'd love to hear you dive into that theory and the timing of it. How quickly do you think that this thing is going to take off?
Well, that's above my pay grade on timing, but my thesis is well grounded, right? As a guy who traded on the options floors for 20, 25 years, I understand options markets. I understand derivatives markets. And the underlying core necessity of any well-functioning derivatives market is that the underlying security has to be freely available to be borrowed, loaned, and shorted. Right? That's just a fact. You cannot have a functioning options market, a functioning derivatives complex, unless you can borrow, loan, and short the underlying asset. Okay, that's why, just for the audience's information, the reason Saylor hit the ATM so hard last year was not just to acquire Bitcoin through that methodology, right? The real reason he hit the ATM so hard was he needed to create the shares, the float, to have a dynamically functioning, well-oiled derivatives complex around MicroStrategy. You wouldn't be able to have products like MSTY or STRC or STRK or convertible notes if you couldn't borrow and short his stock. And he understands this. That was the reason that he pounded the ATM so hard. There is now plenty of stock available. It's easy to borrow. It's freely available to loan. You can short MSTR and get full rebate. That's not an issue. And that's through hitting the ATM. Now, unlike MicroStrategy, Bitcoin is infinitely scarce. There's not enough Bitcoin to support a gigantic derivatives complex. Yet, what do we see being built every day around Bitcoin is a truly gigantic derivatives complex. It's growing with leaps and bounds. And this is a natural function of institutions coming into the game and wanting to minimize their exposure. They want to hedge volatility risk. They want to hedge downside risk. You have long-term holders that have figured out, well, I'm better off hedging my risk to the downside now that I can, rather than selling and incurring a huge tax consequence. So, you know, it's important for the audience to understand that a huge amount of the shorting that takes place in Bitcoin is not people betting that Bitcoin's going to go lower, right? It's economic hedging. If I own 1,000 Bitcoin, okay, let's say I own it at $1,000, and I want to go out and say, look, Bitcoin's trading 115,000. I want to stop out myself at 100,000. And I go to Goldman Sachs and I say, look, I'd like to buy Bitcoin insurance at $100,000. I own this 1,000 Bitcoin. I want to make sure that if it crashes, it goes to zero, at least I get my 100,000. They're going to sell you an over-the-counter put product, essentially. Okay? They've now sold you that put. You want Bitcoin to go higher. You still own 1,000 Bitcoin. Yes, you bought insurance, but by buying insurance, you don't want the product to go down. You want it to go higher, right? Goldman Sachs doesn't want Bitcoin to go down. Then they have to honor their put contract. But they do need to short Bitcoin in order to hedge their downside exposure, right? So you have two parties to a transaction that are creating a need to borrow Bitcoin and short it, but neither party wants to see Bitcoin go lower. They both want to see it go higher, right? So while plenty of people need Bitcoin to short to hedge exposure, that doesn't mean they're betting on the price to go lower. And that's the problem in a derivatives complex. It's not designed for an asset like Bitcoin, right? It's designed for an asset that you can freely borrow and loan and short. And that's not what you have in Bitcoin.
Yeah. So, you know, when we have that, and you have this non-derivative, you know, the infinitely or not infinitely scarce product like all of this, and the derivatives market that is essentially built, essentially needing that. Is there ever going to be a future where there's never going to be like the derivatives market just kind of like runs out? Like, how does this future hold? Is it just going to end in some sort of just giant short squeeze like this? Or is there, you know, going to be some sort of, I guess, like end to this market because there is just such fixed supply with all of this?
Well, everything I know about derivatives tells me that this ends in a mother of all short squeezes, right? For a couple of reasons. And I touched on this earlier. Mm-hmm. Probably the most important characteristic of Bitcoin, beyond the fact that it's completely scarce, is that you can take delivery, right? So Bitcoin that lives on an exchange today might not be there tomorrow.
Why would you ever hold generational wealth on a piece of paper? It doesn't make sense. You need a foolproof solution, and I've got it for you. You could get this as low as $25, and if you use promo code GreenCandle, you could get 10% off. Being around for 12 years, they've engineered the perfect and most easy to use solution. I've partnered with CryptoSteel to offer for you guys just that. It is the cheapest and most secure way to store your seed phrase. I don't know about you guys, but I don't have too many things where I think one ton is going to fall on this, but it could survive all of that and more. So go to CryptoSteel.com. You can use promo code GreenCandle. You can get 10% off your entire order if you go there today. So go ahead and protect your generational wealth and do it with CryptoSteel. All right, enough from me, back to the show.
Bitcoin that's available to short today might not be there tomorrow. So if you have any type of a financial crisis, as I mentioned earlier, right, 08, 09 type scenario where people begin to question the viability of their money in the bank, right? What are they going to do? They're going to pull their Bitcoin out of the exchange. They're going to pull their Bitcoin out of custodial services, and they're just going to hold it on their Trezor until everything calms down, until they have a resolution. But in doing so, they're going to create the fuel to throw on the short squeeze fire. And unlike GameStop or Volkswagen Porsche, there's no CEO to tap on the shoulder and say, hey, look, we need you to sell more Bitcoin, right? Like, that doesn't exist, right? So where do you end up? You end up in a short squeeze that can't be stopped. There is no easy mechanism to put an end to the squeeze. Now, once the squeeze starts, of course, every hedge fund in the world is going to come in and start buying call options, just making the entire situation 10 times worse or exponentially worse, and off you go, right? The only solution to the problem will be, I mean, substantially higher prices. You will have a supply shock the likes of which Wall Street's never seen before.
My God. Well, then I guess that we need to all buckle up at this point. So does that mean that this is the end of the 4-year cycle with this? And then it's going, you know, as Michael Saylor says, up forever, Laura?
Yeah. The 4-year cycle is dead. The 4-year cycle was born out of a miner boom bust cycle with, you know, supply cuts and miners going bust. Today, I just don't see that being a major effect on Bitcoin price. The amount of Bitcoin being acquired just by iBit on and strategy in there, those two entities are acquiring so much Bitcoin on average that they just dwarf anything that the miners can produce.
Well, I'll play devil's advocate with you here, because this is one question that I'm kind of wobbling with. Because yes, I agree, you know, there's only, you know, like what, less than 7-6% left of all coins to be mined. So I think that amount is not going to really, you know, hold weight. But I think there's still two factors here that might play a little bit role into the cycles. Like, one, I think that if you take a step back and look outside of the Bitcoin mining halving cycles, you also got the business cycle, which seems to run every 4 years as well. And then, of course, like the presidential cycle here in the U.S. So those kind of two factors almost seem to help with the boom and bust and maybe have elevated the effects of the halving in a sense. But I'm curious if you think that point is, you know, I guess, worth the argument, or if you just think, you know, it's more about this just the simple supply and demand, and I'm overcomplicating it.
Well, I think the biggest argument you could make is the political cycle, right? The presidential cycle. But I would argue back, well, now that BlackRock is in the game, and you know, we can argue about whether what they control, but I'm kind of in the thesis that they sit on top of all politics. I just don't see the political cycle being the major driver. This doesn't mean we won't have bull markets and bear markets, but I think it's going to be like a traditional asset, a lot more like traditional asset than what Bitcoin has been in the past. So I'm not a believer we're going to see 80% drawdowns. And I would also suggest to you that the last drawdown, the last cycle, was more driven by choke point 2.0. FTX, I believe, was a government operation of sorts. We know how much money was funneled back into politics. Celsius was involved with governments. It's just hard to believe that with the modern framework we have, the political framework, yeah, I just don't see it. I mean, it's possible, but I don't see it.
No, that's all a fair point. I had to play a little devil's advocate with you for all of that. But I mean, we've gone this entire time and we haven't really even talked about the main macro economy and kind of where you think that is. Because I mean, you know, if you look on Bitcoin Twitter, like you said, it seems like we're in a giant asset bubble. You know, if you listen to DJT these days, you know, inflation's dead. If you listen to Powell, inflation's still running rampant. So I'm curious, with your experience, where you think we are, and are you seeing any similarities to any of the times past?
Well, today we got the jobs numbers. They were awful. True inflation came in at 1.6%, well under the 2% target. Look, I think we're headed straight into a crack-up boom. That's what I think. I think prices are just going to go higher. It's going to catch everybody by surprise. Inflation will at some point, you know, pick back up again. Credit creation is the problem. I mean, we just have too much credit creation and the wrong type of credit creation. I don't know if you saw a Richard Werner's piece on Tucker. It was absolutely a dynamic, unbelievable 3 hours. Encourage the audience to go watch that. He did an incredible job of summarizing for me everything I've known is wrong with the banking system, but wasn't able to put into words. Werner is an incredible economist who rightfully predicted the Japanese debacle. He kind of lays out, there's three types of credit creation. There's credit creation to buy assets. There's credit creation for the consumer credit. And then there's credit creation that's actually productive that goes into businesses, goes into hiring and creates productivity. I think he said the numbers today are 85% of all credit is created for asset inflation and consumer inflation. And we know that, right? Banks want to loan on things that have collateral, that are collateralized. They don't want a loan if you go to try to start a business and get a loan. They even if the business you have is cash flow positive, they don't want to make a loan. They want no part of it. And that's part of the problem, is that when you create credit, and that credit's used to buy an asset, that doesn't help GDP at all. It just raises prices. And those prices then get filtered back. Asset inflation certainly leads to consumer inflation, but also credit cards lead to consumer inflation. Money printing leads to consumer inflation. So yeah, given the system we have today with credit creation out of control, I think we go straight into a crack-up boom.
Then does this mean that, you know, all assets are going to essentially rise up to, including S&P 500 and gold as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Gold will seems to be wanting to do the best, better than the S&P. Look, the S&P, it's a cap-weighted index, right? So what we're really talking about is the Mag 7, maybe the top 15 stocks. The other 485 are sort of a drag on the index, if you look at it. And that just speaks to the health of the economy. The S&P 500 has become, in its own way, a measure of monopolies, right? The bigger the monopoly gets, the more powerful and the more representation it gets in the S&P 500. But I think we all know that that's not really good for the economy. It's good for the monopolies.
Yeah. Now let's get into the monopolies. Do you think that there is, I mean, I know Strategy isn't necessarily a monopoly at this point, but you know, they're so far ahead of every other company. Is there a risk where, you know, Strategy becomes essentially too big with all of this? Because what, they have over 600,000 Bitcoin right now, and the next closest is Marathon with like 50K. So it's, you know, the gap between one and two is drastic, whereas the gap between two and three and so on isn't too much.
No, I don't think so. I mean, in the end, Strategy owns, what, 3% of the Bitcoin out there? Mm-hmm. We know the central banks hold about 65% of the gold that's out there. So just compare the two assets. One is truly decentralized. Even the largest player has gotten to 3%. They're going to struggle to get to 5 or 7. It'll be really, really hard for them as the price goes up. So no, I don't see it as a gigantic problem. I think they're going to use that Bitcoin to offer fiat collateralized products like STRC, and that just serves to drain capital out of the financial system and into Bitcoin related products. All that being said, look, I love Strategy, I love Sailor, but Bitcoin in self-custody is the exit ramp, right? If you own Bitcoin, you're able to self-custody it, you put in the work, it's not hard nowadays. When I got involved in 2013, it was scary. Passwords, no seed phrases, right? Like a wallet.dat file. We've come a long way. Organizations like Unchained, Casa, make it really easy to set up multi-sigs. The ability to custody your own Bitcoin's gotten so easy that people just need to put in the work, get their money out of the financial system, and be secure. I sleep really well at night with Bitcoin in self-custody.
Yeah, I mean, as you should. I mean, I think that's the true power of Bitcoin, is being able to hold it, you know, with yourself like that. But, you know, it's interesting kind of the way that you've gotten to all of this with your background, and, you know, the way that we're seeing the financialization of Bitcoin, or I guess maybe it's the Bitcoinization of finance here. You know, how do you see this developing when it comes to, you know, corporations with Bitcoin on the balance sheet, and just for people in general? Because it seems like, you know, now we've got banks starting to come in and allowing banks to custody and all of these different ways. Do you think that we're going to get to this future where people and businesses and everything under the sun is just able to, I guess, get confident enough to custody their own Bitcoin? Or do you think that there's no way out for the businesses? They're going to always need to have some sort of, you know, custodial solution. And, you know, a lot of people in general just feel more comfortable having the banking system and whatever hold their Bitcoin. So self-custody is still a long ways away.
Well, you know, I hate to say it, but I'm kind of in the camp that the next financial crisis might be the last one. Yeah, I'm fearful when I see that banks want to custody and there's all these different institutions that want to custody your Bitcoin, not your keys, not your coins. And don't kid yourself, in some kind of massive financial crisis, the Bitcoin that's in the corporate system will become the government's Bitcoin, and you'll get back the fiat when you least want it, right? So yeah, for my two cents, get out of the system, get your Bitcoin in self-custody. There's no reason to expose yourself to risk when you don't have to.
Yeah, and I agree with you with there. And do you see this with any sort of, you know, scaling risk or anything like that as we're starting to see Bitcoin develop? I mean, of course, you know, the fixed scarce supply of Bitcoin is the true superpower. And I think that's, you know, kind of what you see as well. But, you know, traditionally, it always seems like there's that, you know, the Wall Street guys, they always say, hey, you know, the Keynesian economics sort of thing, like you need some sort of inflation to have the economy grow. Do you see it as that way? Are you seeing Wall Street, I guess, open their eyes a little bit more towards the Austrian economics type of thesis?
These are really good questions, Brandon. look, I see a world that's similar to the Dark Ages going into the Renaissance. Just to kind of paint the historical picture here, Europe was in the Dark Ages. The Medici family created the florin, a gold coin. That gold coin became the standard unit unit and weight and measure of a gold coin throughout Europe, and society flourished. There was abundance with hard money. The arts flourished, music flourished. I think the same thing's going to happen here. Do we need inflation? Absolutely not. But what does a world look like on a Bitcoin standard? There won't be interest rates. There won't be yield on Bitcoin, right? Bitcoin will be loaned from a grandfather to a grandson to start a business. Bitcoin will be loaned inside of a community because abundance creates the willingness to loan Bitcoin. You're not going to do it out of a desire for more Bitcoin back. That's the entire concept of interest rates and yield comes out of an inflationary system. In a deflationary system, I might loan you Bitcoin and take some equity in the business you're starting, but I'm not going to loan you 10 Bitcoin and expect to get 11 back, right? That's not a thing. There's not enough Bitcoin to support that model. That model may work today. Today you can borrow Bitcoin, but in the future, you're not going to be able to borrow Bitcoin or charge interest on Bitcoin because there's not enough Bitcoin available to pay back the interest.
This bull run, I'm looking for ways to stack Bitcoin in my sleep, and mining has always caught my eye. I've partnered with the guys over at Simple Mining to help you do just that. I don't recommend anything that I don't use personally, so I've got a machine up and running with them right this second. And they've even opened the facility up so anyone can go and visit. They manage over 15,000 machines for 500 clients, handling all of the maintenance and repairs so you don't have to. And for the Green Candle listeners, they're giving an exclusive offer: all the repairs for the first year for free. So if you've been thinking about mining, head on over to simplemining.io/greencandle to get this exclusive offer and learn about the potential tax benefits that you can get from mining with Simple Mining. All right, enough from me. Let's get back to the show.
Right, that's just common sense. The math, that's mathematically solid, right? Like that you can't create more Bitcoin. So it's just a different world, right? It's a world of abundance. It's a world of deflation where things get cheaper, right? Nobody can come up with a good excuse why the price of a car goes up every year, right? The price of the car should go down because the technology involved makes it so much cheaper to manufacture. We now have robots. We now have all of this amazing technology. Prices of cars should go down every single year, right? That's the entire concept of an economy, right? Is that as you invest in a better way of doing things, the price goes down. But we live in this crazy inflationary world where the price goes up, even though the technology gets better, even though people create innovations that should make things cheaper, the price still goes up because of inflation. So yeah, it's very hard to wrap your fiat brain around what a Bitcoin world looks like, what a deflationary world looks like when you're in an inflationary environment, and that's all we know. But if you really sit down and think about it deeply, you'd realize that society would be just so much of a better place. We would be a world of tremendous abundance. There would be so much of everything that you need, right? And you wouldn't be buying junk because your money's going up in value, right? One of the things about inflation is it forces you to spend your money on cheap crap that you don't need, right? When you're in a deflationary environment, you're thinking with a Bitcoin mindset, well, if I don't buy this, right, my Bitcoin will go up in value and I'll be able to buy more tomorrow. So it's just a very different way of thinking. You really need to adopt a totally different mindset and then think in that mindset. And I think you get to the fact that we'll be in a much better world.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I think it just, you know, aligns incentives more with people. And, you know, it's interesting because of the way that, you know, we've been taught with everything, you know, really on the Keynesian economics sort of standard and everything along those lines. And, you know, with this, I guess, Bitcoinization of finance that we are seeing, like MSTR, all of the different, I guess, corporations now putting Bitcoin on the balance sheet, it seems like Wall Street still isn't really here too much. I mean, of course, we've got BlackRock and we've got those ETFs, but the narrative around the ETFs is that it's mostly retail buying and it's not a lot of the institutional investors. Is that the way you see it as well, or am I missing the institutional kind of investors starting to come in?
Yeah, they're coming in. You better believe they're coming in. I think right now, I mean, we don't know the exact numbers. If I had to guess, I'd say 25% of IBIT is institutionally held. And remember, these derivatives complexes, that's institutional. So there's a lot of institutional money coming in. Like, I'll give you a perfect example. FTRC, right? So we know that's a 9% instrument. It's set up to attack the money market business. It pays a monthly yield. It happens to pay a dividend instead of interest, when dividend tax rates are extremely beneficial, right? So qualified dividends, obviously much better, much more tax efficient than your standard interest income. Institutions are going to quickly figure out that they can buy STRC and they can hedge the downside in Bitcoin by buying way out of the money puts. And they can lever that product 10x, right? And they can make 50, 60% returns. That's the trade that I see institutions wanting to do. And I think Saylor just stepped on an absolute, like he said, this was our iPhone moment, right? And that's why, is that they're going to quickly figure out how to take these products and create huge yields by levering them up. They're very low risk. And then by hedging the downside exposure using the derivatives market. Again, not designed to support this, but that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, I definitely hear you. Now I want to have a little fun with you here, Darkside. So with your experience and being in Bitcoin for so long, I'm sure you've tried to orange pill some people. For some very smart people in the financial space, what has been the craziest excuse or reasoning why somebody has told you that Bitcoin is not going to work or it's going to fail? Or something along those lines, maybe a little bit different than the traditional FUD that we hear, it seems like, every single cycle.
Well, it's funny because Wall Street really comes back at you with the same narrative. Look, these narratives, the Ponzi scheme narrative, has been sown over years. Like, this is not by mistake, right? These narratives are born out of very sophisticated people thinking very hard on how to protect their monopolies. So yeah, I wish I could come up with crazy stories and tell you some funny stuff, but generally speaking, it really always goes back to it's a Ponzi scheme. But then I have to ask them, well, what is money, right? What is the dollar? The dollar is really a fiat Ponzi scheme, right? And it built into the dollar is all of the characteristics of a Ponzi, right? You have to have deceit. Well, we have something called the debt ceiling, right? The debt ceiling is pure deceit. Anybody who understands how debt works knows you cannot pay down the debt. If you pay down the debt, you cause a deflationary spiral. There won't be enough money to pay the interest on the existing debts. So the debt has to go up. But yet they come up with this crazy debt ceiling thing that Congress has to raise every couple of years because it's a measure of deceit, right? The entire fiat debt-based Ponzi scheme is exactly that. Now, Bitcoin is proof of work. Right? It's actually stored energy. It takes tremendous energy to create Bitcoin through mining. So look, you cannot compare these two systems. And you know what? I don't waste my time on the Wall Street guys because screw them, right? Like they're getting theirs now. I spend my time mostly with Bitcoin Twitter, trying to preach the message of Bitcoin in self-custody and answering the questions, right? That's what really excites me. Trying to get the Wall Street guys on board. And by the way, if you do get them on board, you know what their answer is? Well, that will kill the system. But once they figure it out, they come back at you with, well, wait a minute, that'll blow up the entire system we have. Well, no kidding, right? The two systems are antithetical. They can't peacefully coexist, right? And that's where the whole thing kind of lends itself, right? People that are killing it today on assets and Wall Street, on trading, on high frequency trading, right? They don't want to hear about Bitcoin. And I understand it. I understand why, right? Like it threatens their way of life. But for the bottom 85% of the world, certainly of America, Bitcoin, offers a chance to opt out and to say no more, right? And I think that's who we should be targeting our message to. Right, the top 15%, let them be the last in. But right now we want to get, you know, every American on board, especially, you know, those that are struggling, even with $50 a month, whatever it is, right? You don't, in the end, you're not going to need much to be a very wealthy individual.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I think, you know, just doing that DCA over 4 years, it, you know, really drastically can change your life. I mean, it changed mine 100%. So, you know, I mean, without Bitcoin, I'd be in a completely different place. Who knows? I'd even be, maybe even be in a cubicle at this point in time. So it's definitely been a life changer for me. And that's why I get so passionate about preaching it to everybody, just because of how many more doors it can open and really unlock. And like you said, I think, you know, everybody gets Bitcoin at the price that they deserve. And, you know, I think the Wall Street guys, maybe it's a little bit better that they're coming a little bit later. But Darkside, you've been very generous with your time, so I really appreciate you coming on the show. Why don't you tell people where they can find out more about you, or you know, maybe follow along and hear some of the great things that you preach.
Yeah, so come follow me on Twitter at Darkside2030 underscore. I do a show called On Spaces every Monday through Friday, 8:30 a.m. Pacific, 11:30 Eastern. I also host a bunch of my own spaces, usually really pertinent subjects related to what's going on today. Yeah, I'm pretty much there full time. You know, I'm retired, so this is my work, is giving back to the community. I've been so blessed to be in the position I'm in. So yeah, what an honor it is to be able to come out and just share the message and try to get to as many people as possible.
Yeah, and you're a legend for that. And I definitely recommend those spaces for anybody that hasn't tuned in. And I'll put all that in the show notes. Darkside, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brandon. What an amazing time. I really appreciate you.
Thank you guys all for tuning in to another great episode of the State of Bitcoin podcast. If you found some value in this one, please hit that subscribe button and that like button to help send this one to the masses. And I've got a surprise for you guys. I've got two more episodes that you have the chance to watch here. So go ahead and click one of them, and I'll see you guys all at the next one.